take me as I am. You can't change me, and I can't change you. Our wedding was 6 years ago.
Greetings from BBS Radio, where truth and news still exist in the original form. You're tuned into The Spiritual Politician, the show that shows you where politics, government, and selfishness went wrong, and how you can find the reboot button. I'm Melinda Pillsbury Foster, your host for this hour of insight aimed at making each of us more responsible, more cooperative, and more aware of the spiritual bonds that connect us to each other. No matter what. You can call us toll-free from the U.S. to 877-876-5227. You can call from Canada to 888-810-8322. Or you can call us direct to 530-876-3222. This show is carried online, and you may also be able to get it on the air in your local area to find out if one of those old-fashioned 20th century on-the-air stations in your area carries this show. You just contact us at bbsradio.com. The website for this show can be found on the BBS Radio site and at spiritualpolitician.blogspot.com. All past shows become available as it is humanly or even extra-humanly possible on the station archives. Now, as you probably know, the website is down right now, and the one and only heroic Dawnster is battling the dragons of greed and fate to get it back up. He does that routinely. Thanks, Dawn. My blog is located at howtheneoconstolefreedom.blogspot.com. Now, this week there are again two entries. The first is the article on escaping from the mortgage grid. The second is on the machinations of the neocons as they try to steal the airwaves, even when the possibility of getting them under their coats is so problematical. The second article is the first in a series of articles about Bush trolls. This article is on Kevin Martin, the troll in charge of the Federal Communications Commission. I use the term troll because in common parlance, trolls are creatures who are devious and whose habits include chopping up their victims and converting them into troll chow. That made this characterization of Kevin perfect. Check it out. As to what has been happening this week, last week we heard from Arthur Ogawa about going local, growing local, organizing locally, and rebuilding that very endangered thing we call community. There's no place in this country where we cannot begin again and this time get it right. But to do that, we need to seriously strengthen the learning curve and get better skills for cooperation and replace those institutions we thought were not replaceable with better tools. Arthur has committed to getting some insights online with how they do things at CAWEA, so those will be available ASAP. Also, pretty soon we will have the solution resource up and online. The solution resource will be a wiki that allows you to find out how others have solved problems all across the world so that you can learn from the successes and failures, which are sometimes even more instructive, of others. Arthur warmed the cockles of my author's heart today by commenting he was reading my almost novel, mostly true book, Greed, the Neoconning of America, while sitting at his computer and Googling the various characters in their real-life identities. What a rush. Thanks, Arthur. And you can rally online for Ron Paul at http://rally.ronpaulplanet.org. On the site, you can place your photo and make a statement. Here at BBS Radio, you'll be able to get the skinny on what's going on with the Ron Paul revolution from Nick Bird, who will be reporting from the Iowa Straw Poll and various other places. So expect this excitement to continue here on BBS Radio. And now our thought for the week ahead. Although it's still early in the presidential beauty contest, it has already become more like something from Saturday Night Live with a leavening of hope from the non-corporate candidates Ron Paul, Dennis Kucinich, and sometimes Mike Gravel. You start asking yourself how anyone can take the rest of these people seriously. Then, of course, since you know that people do take them seriously, you start thinking about how nice it would be to live in Panama or perhaps Mars. However, since those are not real options and because I am constitutionally very stubborn, I intend to stick it out and see what we can, that we get the changes that take us to where we should have been in 1783. You see, they should never have cobbled together a federal government or ratified a constitution without making sure everyone's rights were affirmed. If we could sue them now, I would be all for it. But they're all conveniently dead, so what can we do? I say we hit the reboot button. Our shows for the next several months will be following the writing of my book, Climbing Off the Grids to Freedom. Expect every show to show you, so to speak. Those grids that the neocons and their corporate employers were so eager to make sure we stayed staple to can be exited. Those grids are all about, guess what, money. The solutions are all about us as individuals and the communities where we live. Today we're going to talk about another little weapon in their arsenal to staple us to their grid of greed, and that is the Fed. We all shudder when we consider the creature from Jekyll Island and how they managed to so neatly hijack our money. But money is not rocket science, no matter what they want us to think. For most of us, money means security, goodies, unfolding possibilities, stretching out into a future that brings delicious excitements and pleasure instead of pain. Without it, our world is fraught with fear. For Americans, money is that folding green stuff, the line of numbers in our accounts, the knowledge that the plastic we use will keep working. Money, that stuff that provides the useful tools of fungibility, stability of value, and ease of storage, is essential to the present system. But the present system is dead, barely twitching as the last vestiges of value are sucked out. What will Americans do when they realize their money is a lie? The idea of money began as an iconic representation of commodities, shards of poetry, pottery, on which was inscribed the things counted. Sheep, cheeses, and other commodities were among these. That lasted just about as long as it took someone to figure out they could make their own. Since then, currency has moved through several incarnations, as outlined in this poem. Nice when you can get a little utility out of one of these things, from shards to light. For an insight of convenience, they drew marks on shards of clay. The goats and sheep and cheeses thus were counted up each day, and traders' lives were better as barter was replaced with mites of fired pottery that bore each item's face. The marks and shards were money, more fungible to hold, so trade and space were easier. What was owned was sold. But then a cunning taker thought to make his own. The shards went out of favor, replacing coin wrought gold. Issued first by temple and then anointed king, so fungible the medium, it built a wealth in things. Accumulation beckoned the greedy onto thrones. Through money, all were shackled. The people could be owned. A flow of current holdings in increments of gold created flow of currency, and ever more was sold. Price now marked in shiny bits they trusted not to lie. But men saw ways of stealing from weight the coins would buy. So England then replaced them. Their coins had reeded edge. Clipping and the shaving made obvious instead. Money called and promised, so fluid in its scope. Kings and those in power wrote promises on notes. Temptations to debasement, temptations to inflate, became the real foundation of the governmental state. And money still enticed us and draws in those who steal, finessing, redefining the units once were real. Now with no foundation in sheep or even cheese, the money is all funny and only kings are pleased. The flow of human commerce, so easy to abuse, is still the form adopted that all of us must use. We count up paper icons inscribed with those now gone. We trust in those who make them, despite the fact they're wrong. We need the fluid functions that money can provide, while all the self-appointed kings count and so decide. And that's the poem. Now, those in power, from kings to presidents, have always used the system to steal. This has never been more true than in the America of the last century. Fiat money, that endlessly self-multiplying stuff, has allowed the Fed to perpetuate a scheme so outrageous that every Ponzi scheming con man is struck dumb with envy, has enabled government and those corporations like the Fed to spend and trade us into penury. Summer, we're approaching the culmination of the plan so long in the making as such instruments as Blackstone Group LP finish off the job. What do we do when the banks stop printing funny money? How do we buy that loaf of bread? How do we survive? There are answers, and there have been warnings. Our guest tonight is Jim, and Jim Capo is a successful businessman who became aware of the game while by starting his own business in North Carolina. Now he spends his time awakening Americans to the hazards all of us face. From 1985 to 1986, he worked in Japan with the company's joint venture partner, Polyplastics Limited. This was during the first main wave of Japanese companies establishing production facilities in the United States in order to increase market share for their products, while avoiding calls for trade sanctions to offset the ballooning trade imbalance between the then two largest economies in the world. The market niche success of his own company notwithstanding, Mr. Capo has long been concerned about the general plight of America's manufacturing and economic base, as well as the continued encroachments by both national and international regulation on the free enterprise system. It was during his work to defeat the North American Free Trade Agreement that he became aware of the John Birch Society, which he joined in 1993. In 2003, Mr. Capo sold off his stake in Team One Plastics. Now he travels, educates people to the problem, and writes. So please welcome Jim Capo. Jim, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Thank you for having me, Melinda.
Well, thank you so much for being with us. Now, I sort of got right into the fact that you're a member of the John Birch Society because we had talked about that, and I think that it's kind of interesting for people to find out what sort of strategy was used to marginalize the message of the John Birch Society in 1966.
Okay, I think you should clarify, too, I'm not only just a member, but a staff member on the payroll of the John Birch
Society. Oh, wow, that's hard.
Yeah.
They don't pay very many people very much because they're very thrifty with their money, I know.
It is a missionary kind of work.
It is. It must be, because that's what happened in 66, of course, was that the John Birch Society was attacked by Mr., what do they call him, pointy nose? William Buckley.
Yeah, William F. Buckley.
Yes. And what he did, of course, was claim that they were marginalized fringes, right?
Well, you know, the John Birch Society said a lot of things that tweaked the noses of the establishment, the power elite. They, right off the bat, they started talking about some of the, in addition to the whole communists are within our government they also started talking about the Federal Reserve System and how, you know, it's robbing us of our wealth.
Uh-oh.
But the ultimate sin was, as a hardcore constitutionalist right-wing organization, having the leader, Robert Welch, come out in 1965-66 and start saying, get out of Vietnam, it's a trap.
Yeah,
and that was the end of the road. That was when Buckley stepped in and said, okay, these guys are kooks now.
That is so funny, because, of course, now you look at back in history and everybody agrees that was a horrible mistake. But then, of course, they were, oh, you guys are fringes.
Yeah, I know. It was interesting, though, but, you know, so the Birch Society was given a little bit of rope there, but then as soon as Robert Welch stepped out against the war in Vietnam, they really started putting the hammer down on things, and that's when Buckley, just previous to that, well, at that point, Buckley tried to wrestle control of the Birch Society away from Robert Welch and to become its own, you know, he tried to become the leader of the Birch Society. That didn't go very far.
Mm-hmm.
Welch was smarter than that when he set the organization up, so it was pretty easy to dispatch with Mr. Buckley. But Mr. Buckley and his supporters turned around and went on a pretty vicious campaign to smear the society with all kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess it's just, you know, two main things, I guess, you know, being honest, the two things that were going on at the time, you know, it's the height of the civil rights movement, and you've also got the Birchside talking about the Federal Reserve System, you know, going back through with the founding of the Fed in 1913 and everything. So here we are out there, you know, if you're talking about, you know, the federal government should be out of education. The federal government should not get into public education. It should not get into the state education system. Oh, well, then you're, you know, a neo-Confederate or a, you know,
a fascist or some weird segregationist thing.
You know, da-da-da-da. So it's really easy to play that card. You know, only racists would be against the federal government getting involved in public schooling.
Of course, now we have no child left unmolested in our school system.
Unbelievable. And then the other thing, of course, is the Fed. If you're attacking the Fed, well, you're attacking the bankers. And if you're attacking the bankers, well, certainly you must be one of those ones that think that there's an evil cabal of, you know, bankers. And we know that means Jewish cabal, so you must be anti-Semitic. So that was the other charge laid against the Birch Society is, you know, don't attack the bankers.
Well, the bankers didn't want to be attacked. That was very clear. But one thing I found fascinating about the timing of all this is this happened in 65, 66, and in California what's happening is Ronald Reagan is also assuming the mantle of conservatism, which he actually had never lived, and becoming the Republican candidate for governor, you know, and betraying the Yurok and the conservative movement.
Well,
and you could see that there's a parallel here between William Buckley and Reagan.
Yeah. Well, there's one other thing I just to back up to, 65, 66. You know, if President Kennedy had not been assassinated, you might have still had at least silver coinage going into 65, 66. But one of the first acts that Lyndon Johnson took coming to power was, let's just go through with the decoupling of our money from silver, and that ended. So you had that was going on, and then the war, and then you got Ronald Reagan in California, you know, and he gets his famous speech there during the Goldwater campaign, and you know, it rockets him to fame, I guess. I wasn't around then.
You weren't paying attention.
Yeah, I was in kindergarten or something, I think. Nonetheless, you know, so this is all going on, and then you get Bill Buckley coming in here, promoting himself as the, you know, the great answer to the conservative movement, and clearly he was just a shill for the establishment.
Well, he was very much a Rockefeller Republican, which is Eastern establishment.
Yeah, all the way. You know, Princeton graduate, you know, belonged to all the right clubs and organizations and groups and societies, and I think his wife was rumored to have been, you know, pretty friendly with the CIA, and there's a book out that was put out by the president of the John Birch Society a couple of years back called William F. Buckley, Piper for the Establishment. That was written by John F. McManus, who's the president of the Birch Society, and he just basically, you know, details what we're just starting to get into here, is that you had a true conservative movement led by a true Taft Republican, Robert Welch, considered himself a Taft Republican, just like Ron Paul, for those who... No, you know, Ron Paul's 71 years old or so, so he's using terminology of his time, and it used to be if you said you were a Taft Republican, that meant you were a real Republican and not a establishment Republican or a Rockefeller Republican.
That's some history that we need to learn.
Yes, yeah, because now, you know, the Taft Republicans kind of became the Goldwater Republicans, and then Ronald Reagan kind of insinuated himself into the system and somehow they became, if you were a Reagan Republican, you were following in the tradition of Taft and Goldwater, but...
No, you weren't. No, we left. Remember, the libertarians left in 71.
Yeah, well, see, that's... But I mean in the mass media.
Well, yes, in the mass media.
In the mass media, if you read the mass media, it was kind of like, well, you had some Taft Republicans, but you know, they became... they may have floated around a little bit and lasted until the Goldwater era, but then Reagan comes on the scene, and he's kind of the... carrying the mantle forward. Well, you know, it was totally phony. And like you said, that's why, and just like today in the Ron Paul campaign, you know, young people are a lot quicker, I think, to recognize hypocrisy and deal with it in a forceful fashion as opposed to older people who tend to recognize the hypocrisy possibly, but just, you know, they learn to go along to get along, pragmatic, all that good stuff, and they'll stay they'll stay the course, whereas younger people will say, hey, I'm out of here. You know?
Yeah, stay the course, jump off the cliff.
Yeah, that's right off the end of the cliff. So you had the Republican, you had the Libertarian movement form, you know, when the younger crowd recognized, you know, you had people like Murray Rothbard and other, you know, paragons of the movement, you know, talking about some of these things, and everybody said, hey, why are we sticking around the Republican Party? Let's get with the Libertarians, that's the way to go, and, you know, the Libertarian Party was founded.
That's what happened, and then, of course, we come into the Reagan presidency, which is where everything falls apart.
Yes. Well, we destroyed the evil empire.
Yes, right. And then we became the evil empire.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I always said, you know, the evil empire wasn't destroyed. It just simply migrated over to the United States. And, you know, they're sitting and running a lot of our, you know, universities and colleges and government agencies.
Yes.
NSA, Homeland Security, they kind of rise to the top of my list, at the top, off the top of my head here. But, yeah, so we have become the enemy.
We have met the enemy, and he is us. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
Now, when I said that the Reagan administration laid down the groundwork, that really is true, and that takes us right back to the Fed. Because what happened there was they changed the economic policies.
Yeah, Reaganomics.
Yes, Reaganomics, which had nothing to do with the free market. Which America had kind of grasped. That people had thought, well, at least we have the free market.
Yeah, and that, you know, if you cut taxes and put the rich people in better, more power, that's the free market at work. That's good.
Right. Except, of course, it's not.
their taxes were cut, but the rich people, or the people, of, I shouldn't say rich people. I don't want to downgrade rich people, but the people in power, of course, yeah, they didn't want to pay as many taxes, but. They didn't want to let go of the size and scope of the government either.
Well, they had been used to using the government as such a wonderful tool to augment their income. They certainly wouldn't have wanted to let go of that.
Yeah, see, this is where it's kind of interesting. You know, I work as a coordinator for the John Birch Society in the Carolinas, and you know, you'll meet people that are younger. You know, anybody under 40, they have maybe just a vague understanding of what we're into or what we're about or what we've done. You know, where we're going. Where we've been, and sometimes you'll meet somebody who, you know, kind of got a public education and a mass media education, and they're kind of confused, and I'll talk to them about some of the positions of the Birch Society, and if you look at what we're doing, sometimes they'll get a stare, and they go, well, aren't you guys, like, related to Greenpeace or something like that? You're, like, anti-corporation or, you know, so they get a part of our message, and actually part of our message does, you know, to be fair to the people that are saying this thing. I've had some people say, you know, I thought you guys were communists or something. But to be fair to them, you know, what they're seeing is, or what they're hearing in bits and pieces is, here's this organization that's railing against the establishment, the ruling elite, the ruling establishment, the insiders, and, you know, all the power that are in these corporations that are not free market corporations, they're fascist corporations.
That's absolutely true. And that's one thing people don't get about it. They don't get what they're actually talking about is a fascist state that's slowly been eating America alive. Actually, I would date that from mercantilism.
Yeah, it goes back that far. Well, so what's interesting is I can sit down today and be talking to somebody that works for Public Citizen or Greenpeace, and, you know, we'll be agreeing on a lot of stuff as far as the problem, okay? But then we turn to the solution, and the John Birch Society solution is based on, you know, free market Austrian school economics, in the economic realm, in the political or moral realm, is more based on, a scriptural, biblical, you know, greater grants us rights kind of background. But if you just work on what the problems are, you know, there's a lot of agreement with us and what represents, in a lot of cases, what's considered the left.
Mm-hmm.
But the solutions, of course, you know, they somehow believe that even though these big evil corporations that have control of the government, if we just made government bigger and more powerful, then the evil corporations wouldn't, you know, be able to be brought to heel.
Yeah, right, like they could ever make that work.
Yeah, I know.
Never.
Whereas our argument is, no, the government's the tool of
like,
the big corporations.
Like, did you ever guess that we did a beta test and it didn't work?
Yeah.
But the Fed, of course, now that was founded in 1913, and I refer to it as the creature from Jekyll Island because that's how a lot of people refer to it.
Well, that's because there's a book that the John Birch Society commissioned back in the late 80s, and it came out in the early 90s. It's called Creature from Jekyll Island, The Second Look at the Federal Reserve. That was a book that the Birch Society felt pretty strongly about, so, you know, commissioned to have it written. And it's been a very successful book, and that was actually the first book I read after joining the John Birch Society. I was in business, you know, had a you know, pretty decent company with a good cash or a good sales position. We had a credit line and banking, and, you know, here I'm doing all this stuff, and I didn't realize that, wait a minute, I don't really understand the nature of money. And I started reading this book, and I was fascinated by it, about how the Fed was formed and how fractional reserve banking works. And, you know, I always had this vague notion that, well, you know, I give my money to the bank, it,
they
know,
hold on to it for me.
They hold on to it for me. They give me 5% interest on it while they loan it out at, 7 or 8% interest, and they're super efficient, and they make money off that 3% differential. And I never realized that they're making it off that 3% differential because of fractional reserve banking. They can put about a 7 or 8 or 9-to-1 multiplier on that.
So and that brings up a very interesting question. Why don't you give us that again, explain exactly what the Fed does with their money?
Well, it's not the easiest thing, but I guess the shortest way to explain it is, you know, a lot of people think that, you know, you put money in the bank takes your money and they loan it out to somebody else, and that is true. But under the Federal Reserve Act and the rules of the Federal Reserve System that were created in 1913, the Federal Reserve can, the member banks of the Federal Reserve can take that, they can take your $100 deposit, they can loan out, originally it was something like, you know, you had to maintain something like 10% of it. So they could take your $100 deposit, loan out $90, and collect interest on that $90. However, under the rules of the system, they can say, well, now I have this $90 loan with this other customer. I have a loan out to them for $90. And that loan, which is an IOU, suddenly becomes, in the Federal Reserve rules, a asset of the bank. So now that I have this $90 asset, I can loan out 90% of that. So I can loan out another $81.
They've rewritten all the rules so that now they've converted a debit line to a credit line.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is
so
sort
this
of
is the liability of the bank.
About it. It makes Christ did look like nothing.
Yeah. Well, if you were in some other business, if you had a car, a rental business, and you rented out your car to somebody for the week, and now the car is gone. But imagine a system where, well, you rented it out to the one guy for a week, but somehow you found a way that, well, when that person's not using the car, you can get another person to use the car at the same time or something like that.
Right, and you get paid twice.
Yeah, you get paid twice. And that's how the Federal Reserve System works, is they can take the original loan and they can loan it out again. So with your simple first $100 investment, they can do 90% of 90% of 90% of 90%, and that comes to something like seven-fold increase. They create about $700 of loans off your $100 deposit.
Talk about the loaves and the fishes.
Yeah, exactly. And then, of course, the other thing, then along the way, of course, well, you know, 10%, you know, we've got such efficient banking now, and, you know, we've really protected things, and there's all these hedging systems and that have developed over the years, since the Fed's been formed. So, 10% was probably a little excessive. We could probably let banks only keep 7% or 5%. And then, some banks are down to like 3% or something. You know, it depends on how crafty they want to get with their, and that's the pro forma balance sheet of the bank, not the what's actually on the books, So you might have banks that are leveraged where they might only have 1% reserves based on what they got out there. So
if somebody comes in and wants their money, they're not going to get it. That's what we call run on the bank, right?
That would be run on the bank, although our current head of the Federal Reserve, Mr. Bernanke, said that, prior to getting his job, he was, helicopter Ben. You'll get your money. There's just no guarantee how much it'll buy.
Actually, that's
a quote of Alan Greenspan. There was a point where they're asking him what was going on about with government liabilities for Social Security, medical, Medicaid, all these entitlement programs of the federal government. What's going to happen there? How are we going to be able to keep paying these? And Greenspan's answer was something along the lines of, Well, you know, we can. The Federal Reserve can guarantee that people will be paid and will receive their dollars they're expecting. We just can't guarantee how much those dollars will buy because they've debased the value of the dollar. You'll get $100, but it won't buy $100 worth of stuff.
Right. We're talking about the, you know, post-World War One Germany with a wheelbarrow, and here's your postage stamp.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's, of course, what we're all lined up to have happen right now, which is why everybody's terrified.
Well, because this system, at the outset, this system is a fraud. It's a scheme, a Ponzi scheme. And every once in a while, they have to crash the system and reboot, as you say. And so we got to try to figure out here, as we're getting close to another reboot, that, you know, we'd like to see the, you know, this would be, while they're trying to reform us with something equally as bad or worse, we need to be thinking, well, what's the way out to some new system that's, you know, a grassroots you know, system driven by, you know, a bunch of free individuals that want to get out from underneath the, you know, the system that's been imposed on us by the ruling elite.
Yes, it does make you feel like you're crushed.
Or the grid that's been way down, you know, dropped down, the net that's been dropped on us.
Yeah.
From above.
And I got some questions from listeners and that were emailed. And the first one is there a practical alternative to fiat money?
Well, we didn't always have fiat money, so I guess the short answer is yes. I don't think a lot of people think that. Well, we're in such a complex the current modern economy is so complex we could never you know, go back to a gold standard or any kind of hard money standard. But you know, it can be done. I mean, that the technology allows that to happen. I mean, we have the technology to do it.
And of course, in the past, we've used gold. Because, you know, gold has this nice characteristic that it retains its value and it'll sit there and not do anything.
And it's hard to make more of it out of, you know, you can't just create it out of nowhere. It takes work and effort to get it.
You have to dig it out of the ground, which is a big, annoying mess.
Right.
And messy, dirty sort of thing to do. So it's always made it worth more money. It actually is also very useful in the electronics industry.
Yeah, it's the best conductor for all these high-tech computer chips and everything.
Yeah.
All the gold wiring connects your processor to your computer.
People have talked about different bases for a currency. And there's been some discussion about electronic bases for a currency that would be objective. That's just one thing I know that people
have
talked about.
Well, the person asking the question is, how can we live without a fraudulent system? Well,
yeah, that's exactly the question that's really being asked. How can we live without a fraudulent system?
Yeah. And so the answer is, well, you know, as long as we have frauds running it, the answer is we probably can't. But if there was a way to wrestle things back, and the argument I use is, you know, how did the United States, you know, if you look back through the history of, you know, mankind and development and progress, you know, there was a sudden burst of development and freedom that occurred in the United States after the Revolutionary War and you know, going into World War II. And there's a great book that kind of the second book you read when you join the John Birch Society after Creature from Jekyll Island is an old book that was written in the 1940s, late 40s, called Mainspring of Human Progress. And it was written by a market research analyst at General Motors. And he was trying to come to terms with the idea, well, why did we have, you know, how did we go from, in less than 100 years, from, you know, people basically living off the land like they had for thousands of years, you know, the wood is the major source of fuel, and, you know, people are working in the fields, and, you know, he's basically talking from the time period of about, you know, 1840 to 1940, okay? And then by 1940, you've got TVs, radios, nylons, aircraft, jet engines, atomic bombs. How this happened in just 100 years? And, you know, he pointed the answer to what is the mainspring of human progress is freedom. And what he was pointing out was in the United States, you had an incredible amount of freedom that if he didn't go into this, but the way I kind of always viewed it was, you know, what was really happening there is you had a period of time from the time the old world discovered the new world across that up to and through that 100 years, you had this sudden amount of land, which was the previous delineator of wealth, you know, you had your wealth all came from the land, you know, whether
right.
what you farmed or dug out of the ground or whatever, the sheep or cattle grazing the land. Land was pretty key, and suddenly there's this huge amount of land dropped into the scene with only a sparse population of native inhabitants on it that could be pushed out of the way, and suddenly there's all this land available, and the powers that be, you know, they were able to grab off big chunks of that land, but they weren't able to get all of it because there was all, you know, there's people showing up on the shores of the United States, of America. They're getting their own little chunk of the action, and it was just too big for a human system to get their arms around and control right away.
So are you saying that the reason that there was freedom wasn't that they necessarily intended that there be freedom, but the people grabbed it?
Right. There was a sudden. I think there was a sudden. I mean, obviously there were certain things written in the Constitution and our system, and although there's some good things and bad things in there, but you know, so that helped that men came forward and said, "Look, we're going to throw off the yoke of kings, and you know, rights come from a creator. Governments are established to protect those rights," and they basically took a lot of the political arguments off the table for mortal men to argue about and said, well, these are beyond the scope of what mortal men can steal from you. You know, it's a divine source of your rights, so therefore mortal men can't conspire and take them away from you because they're divine. So that kind of helped probably too, but it was probably significant in the whole thing. But you still had this thing where there was so much going on, they couldn't get their hands around it all, and so that gave opportunities for regular people to, you know, find their own way. You know, here you had a society suddenly where nobody really came in contact with government. You know, back
true.
In Europe, you still had the king and his ministers and his troops.
And the West was always much freer it was in the East, which is why people would go there.
Well, and even at the time of the Revolution, or right after the Revolution, when there's a good quote from Thomas Jefferson when he was president, he said, you know, the average American, you know, how great it is to be an American and what freedom is, the average American never comes in contact with government. Yeah, I mean, wasn't that a great system?
That's a great quote.
Yeah, I mean, the average American never sees anybody from his government because they're just not a part of his life. He can get by without them, and that was a great time, you know, in American history where you didn't see much of your government. Now, you know, try to get by without government.
So what you're saying is we could get away from them.
Well, I don't know what I'm saying.
You could head for the wilderness, and then they weren't there.
Well, and what I try to inspire upon people is, you know, of course, the land's all been gobbled up, and, you know, now the powers that be have kind of gotten their control of the land over again. But now you have, that's the real world. But the virtual world is this whole new world that suddenly hit the scene here in the last 10 or 15 years. And the powers that be, you know, are partially, just like the new world was, you know, put together by people who had, you know, money and capital to develop it. You know, same thing with the Internet and the virtual world, but it's just so... there's just so much activity and creativity going on that the powers that be can't quite, you know, they're trying to get their arms around it, and they've got some pretty good inroads, obviously, but it still represents an area where it's kind of like this little window, the same kind of window we had when America was free and you didn't, you know, have to worry about what your government was doing.
It was definitely freer. They're trying to get their arms around it. Of course, one of the things that they've been doing is they've been messing around with our currency.
No, and well, that's the. I mean, you know, follow the money. I mean, that was
follow the money, follow the money, follow the money. Yeah.
And, you know, I think there's the three. You know, one of the things we talk about. You know, the Birch Society is big on. You know, we don't like the Council on Foreign Relations, which was started in 1921 after the League of Nations fell through. The same guy that helped found the Council on Foreign Relations, Edward Mandel House, was also a top advisor of President Wilson, and Mandel House helped put together the Federal Reserve Act.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and so we bang on the CFR, and then we also bang on a more newer version or newer rendition, which is the Trilateral Commission, and trilateral could mean Europe, America, and Asia, Japan, but it also trilateral is also referred to as, you know, the three things you got to control: money, or, you know, currency, money, food, and energy.
Mm-hmm.
You get those three going, if you got a pretty good handle on those three, you can control people pretty well.
Yes, you can, and they've taken certain steps, and one of the things they've done is that the national debt skyrocketed. We used to be a credit become a credit country, and now we're a debt country.
Yep, we're enslaved by debt.
Absolutely, completely enslaved, and that's obviously where they wanted us to go, because they've made that so very possible. And if we'd really been on a free market basis, it wouldn't have been. It's been a very much a managed economy. And but most citizens still are feeling very little pain at present. You know, you can see that things are starting to happen. People are starting to, their comfort level's going down. But still, they believe that things are going to come back up, and the indicators are that they won't. They're actually going to come apart.
The people aren't feeling the pain right now. They're nervous because intuitively they think this can't keep going, but they're not feeling the pain yet because those who control money, or credit and food and energy have been doing a great job of making sure that there's plenty of credit to go around and plenty of relatively cheap energy to go around.
Uh-huh.
And even with $3 a gallon or $4 a gallon, that's, you know, in inflationary terms, that's not as high as it has been in the past. So that's legitimate for the people that point that out. But what I was getting at is for these last 20 or 30 years that we've been going massively into debt, and people have been just, you know, keeping their lifestyle going by taking on more debt, they've been able to do that because the credit's been the liquidity in the credit market has been fabulous. You know, open your mail any day and you got 10 chances for, upping your credit card or getting a new one or taking a mortgage out on your house. Or, you drive down the street and you see these car lots that have little signs up that says, you know, no credit, bad credit, no problem, everybody rides. You know, they find a way to get you into the car.
And they'll do anything they can to get you on the credit grid.
Yes.
And all of the other grids, which, of course, are all driven by the Fed. And that's sort of where we are. And those are, and all the things that we've talked about so far are the things that sort of hold you on the grid, and they're sort of the problem. And we've just touched barely on the solutions. Because, of course, the chickens are going to come home to roost. Things are going to happen, and we're still going to need the functionalities of money. But we won't be able to use the fiat money.
What we want to do is implosion or some kind of rejiggering the system is, you know, afoot here, real close. And instead of the people that are in control convincing everybody, you know, we've got to somehow wrestle away and win the argument of those in control are going to come up and show us, you know, here's the way out, which is just going to be an equally bad or worse system that we're already using. We've got to argue that we want a system, this is our chance to move away towards a system that's not based on theft.
Yes.
We have to have a system that's not based on theft.
Well, and a lot of people across the country are working on alternative exchange systems that don't necessarily, some of them, issue script.
Mm-hmm.
And those are all extremely interesting things, and people are having different degrees of success with them. You're sort of going through what I think of as a beta test period here.
Mm-hmm.
And one of those things is local exchange trading systems. And what they do is you get credit, non-interest credit, by doing things so that you can put in childcare, do childcare for somebody, and then that person will put in carpentry work.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't have to exchange it between the two of you. It goes into a credit system.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one way that people are experimenting with getting
a credit
around
system where the credits can't be created without some useful work being done to create the credit, as opposed to the current system.
Absolutely.
Where the credit is just made up for whoever, for those who need it.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
Those in control, you know.
And there's a website for this, and I want to give the listeners the website. It's http://www.gmlets.u-net.com. And
can you give the www part after? What was that again?
www.gmlets.u-net.com. And as I started looking at these things, I found about 80 different areas where people are doing different things, including things that have become pretty widespread. There's something that people are calling free exchange, and it's a website. You go on, you list an item for free, and then you can get an item for free. And that's going on very broadly all across the United States now.
Mm-hmm. And what's that? That's called Free Exchange. Is that a website?
Free Exchange.
Freeexchange.com?
It's, I think so, but I didn't write that one down.
Okay.
I had a friend that used it, and she told me about it, and I went and looked, and then I forgot to write it down. But it's out there. If you do a Google search, you can very easily find
it.
Okay,
I'll check it out.
And all of these things are exchange systems, which are a substitute for currency in the present system that we have. And I think this, you know, it brings up the question is, will we ever go back to the kind of system that we had, or are we going to come up with a sort of layered system that has things that's happening at the local level and then has other things that are happening that are at broader regional level?
I guess in a simple way of looking at it is the same technology that affords us the ability to create the total surveillance state could also be used for a good purpose to create a system of credits for tracking exchanges of goods and services that avoids having to use this, you know, fiat, phony, funny money.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you could use the technology for man's betterment as opposed to simply using it to maintain
to
the surveillance.
It's
the surveillance state you need to have when you got a bunch of criminals running the top of the organization.
Yes, absolutely. And if you take a look at all the different things that are available out there and what people are doing and working with, I think that there actually is a lot of reason to be very hopeful at this point. Because, you know, we're not going to be left in the lurch. There are going to be things that people can do that where they can get that loaf of bread, where they can figure out how to get food, where they're going to be able to handle a lot of different parts of their lives. But
there's stuff that's doable. I think, I don't know, you know, the demographics of the general listening public out there tonight, but, you know, older people tend to be a little bit worried because, you know, they've only got so many years left to, you know, earn money or whatever, so they have to be tend to be a little bit more conservative. And you say change, and like, change, they'd be tempted to change back to the way it was or some modification of the way it was, which might not get us anywhere, where you got younger people that are, you know, under 30 years old, and, hey, give me a better system. I'll figure it out. I'll make money at it. I'm willing to work and do my part and work in a new system, and they're, you know, that's going to be the people that drive things, and I think it's interesting. You're looking like the Ron Paul campaign. Here's a guy that's out there very prominently saying, you know, the Fed's got to go.
He's absolutely said that, and I think one of the interesting things.
And he's got young people flocking to his campaign, thinking, "Hey, I'm with you. Let's try something new. I can tell, you know, I know enough to know what's working. What we got isn't working."
And one of the interesting things about the Ron Paul campaign in terms of money, because of course they always say, "Oh, well, you haven't raised as much money." Well, not only does he not spend as much money, but if you take a look at what is actually there in terms of people going ahead and printing their own literature, doing their own bumper stickers
mm-hmm.
that never, ever, ever go through the accounting system that then feeds back into the Federal Election Commission, I think that probably he has a much larger campaign than people realize.
Oh, definitely. I was there in South Carolina during the debate, you know, the famous debate where Giuliani blew up and lost his cool. I was there in South Carolina with the Birch Society and other Birch members, and then also some libertarian people and just Ron Paul supporters. We just kind of a crowd of us handing out our different literature. We had just put out the magazine of the John Birch Society. It's called The New American Magazine.
Mm-hmm.
You can go to thenewamerican.com. And anyway, so we had a magazine. Just by chance, we happened to have had a recent interview with Ron Paul talking about all his positions on everything. So we had this copy of the magazine that we were handing out to promote the magazine at the same time. There was the Ron Paul interview you could hand out. And then we had another copy, I think, that had a Duncan Hunter interview in it.
Mm-hmm.
So we weren't playing favorites. We, you know, here was the two candidates that gave us interviews, and we were handing out their stuff, and the Ron Paul supporters were. But there was, like, probably, you know, a couple of dozen of us outside, you know, working the crowd, doing things on behalf of the campaign. And there was people, you know, young, old, quite a mix. There's a group called the Granny Warriors that had this big mobile home all painted up with the Ron Paul banner on it. And
very visible.
Very slow, very visible. It was right out there in the thick of things. And so that was all going on. And then you go to outside the auditorium, there was all these yard signs that had been put up, and there were some there for, you know, mostly McCain. At that time, McCain was still in the game. There was mostly McCain and Romney, and there was a handful of Giuliani signs. But outside was interesting. So you had these Ron Paul supporters kind of milling around with handmade banners and doing all this stuff. And the only supporters that were, you know, visible for McCain and Romney, each side had about maybe 15 to 20 college students from the local colleges were, you know, kind of shouting at each other across the sidewalk.
Mm-hmm.
And that was it. You know, that was it. So the Ron Paul had as many people out there as McCain and Romney had. And Giuliani, who was, you know, big Mr., you know, first, second, third, or whatever, there wasn't a single person there that had a Giuliani button or sign or anything. The only way the signs got put up, I think, is he paid somebody a service to go put the signs up, and that was it. Now, he had people that were, you know, paid the couple hundred bucks to get inside and be inside and clap for him when he, you know, tried to challenge Ron Paul that he didn't have a clear understanding of why we got attacked on 9/11. But nonetheless, if you just looked at the campaign support, like you're talking about, the grassroots, you know, people putting in money an hour or putting in their own time and money, Ron Paul was certainly competitive with the mm-hmm. big three. And you can quickly see why somebody like any of the top guys, if their money runs out, their support runs out because they only have support because they have money they're spending.
That's right. And, of course, it's completely different with Ron Paul because
yeah.
if he ran out of money, everybody would pony up and give him some more money.
Yeah, or do
or
the work
just go
for
do
free,
it
or just show up anyway. Just tell me where I gotta be. You know, there's a huge I have a son that's in college, and you know, all his college buddies, you know, they got their little Facebook accounts, and all these Ron Paul banners are popping up all over Facebook. And Ron, you know, when they say that it's just a, you know, some kind of conspiracy of Ron Paul techies or whatever. Creating this on the internet, you know, it's not. It's a bunch of individual people.
Yes, and they're just people who have very strong opinions about it because they're fed up. I think one of the things that's amazed me the most that way is how many of them were never interested in politics at all, and all of a sudden they've popped up and they're doing this, and they're just going like gangbusters.
Well, and the other thing that you know, young people, you know, do not suffer hypocrites as well as older people. You know, older people are willing to. You know, accept the hypocrite's answer is kind of, well, that's the pragmatic answer or whatever. You know, I understand. I've lived a long life, and I understand that things don't always, you know, sometimes you got to play the game. But younger people don't like to hear that. And, you know, they see hypocrisy, you know, the heck with it. Let's move on. Like we, you know, we were talking about earlier with the young Republicans bolting the party and forming the Libertarian Party.
It's so going to be very interesting.
That same thing's happening today.
It's going to be very interesting to see what would happen if he was elected and he really ended the Fed. That would be amazing. When you think about how that would impact America, it's just mind-boggling.
Well, I think that's why there's probably a good reason why one of his campaign slogans is revolution, because that would be revolutionary.
It reminds me a little bit of when Andrew Jackson ended the bank.
Oh, yeah. He killed the Fed.
He killed it. I mean, he did it in his own generation.
I mean, he killed the bank. I'm sorry. He killed the bank.
Killed the bank, yes. It wasn't, well, it was the equivalent of the Fed.
Right.
For that time. Well, you know, this has been really wonderful. I'm so glad you could be with us this evening so we could talk about these things.
Yeah,
and I'm really hoping you're going to come back again.
Sure.
And so we can get into that and to a lot of other issues.
Well, thanks for making the venue available. I think it's a great way to get the word out, and appreciate your effort on behalf of freedom.
Well, thank you so much.
All right. Thanks, Melinda.
God bless you. Take care.
All right. Bye-bye.
Good night. And that's our show for today, Friday, August 3rd, 2007. At The Spiritual Politician, we tell you about ways you can connect to others to solve problems and make life better for all of us. On this show, as we do with all our shows, we end by reading the section of the Declaration of Independence that is America's mission statement then and now. This remains where we want to go. It's up to each of us to ensure we reach the destination. As Jefferson said, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed, that whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it, and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. Prudence, indeed, will dictate that governments long established should not be changed for light and transient causes, and accordingly, all experience has shown that mankind are more disposed to suffer while evils are sufferable than to right themselves by abolishing the forms to which they are accustomed. But when a long train of abuses and usurpations, pursuing invariably the same object, evidences a design to reduce them under absolute despotism, it is their right, it is their duty, to throw off such government and to provide new guards for their future security. This is Melinda Pillsbury Foster coming to you from BBS Radio. God bless the journey that brings us to freedom, and may God be with you every step of the way. Good night.
She beckons you from mirrored pools as the moonlight shines like jewels upon her face. Her hips begin to move and swell, hold you with their ancient spell, till all you wish to do is live forever in her grace. Yeah.
Hi, everybody. This is Senior Seaver, and you're listening to Dr. Bell. Well, I forgot to say who I am. Sorry about that.
Yeah, go ahead. Well, keep that done. Be sure and keep that in there. I like those improvs. Yeah, go ahead. Especially with a laugh and all that.
Yeah. Who am I? I just forgot.